James 1:4 through 1:5, the third talk in a series on James, was presented by Ron Julian on January 8, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
We are continuing on this morning in the book of James. Actually, it's been several weeks since we've been at this, so let me remind you, we're in the book of James. I'm taking us fairly slowly through the first part of the book. We've only looked at three verses so far. And today we're going to look at two more, maybe one and a half. There are some very important, I think, key concepts that are going to be relevant to the whole book, so I want to try to take some time to explain them, and then as we get those under our belt, we'll be able to go a little faster as we go along. Let me paraphrase what I think James has just said before the section we're looking at. This is a very broad paraphrase, filling in a lot here. I know that you all have been going through many hardships, but I urge you to think about the testing of your faith as a good thing, as something to value and rejoice in. Why? Because the process of proving the genuineness of your faith results in your persevering in faith, and perseverance in faith is a very valuable thing. So that's where we are. We're continuing on now with verses 4 and 5, where he says, this is not my paraphrase now, but perseverance is to have a perfect work, that you may be perfect and whole, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. In order to explain what I think James is getting at here, I'm going to talk about three words, and then I'm going to answer three questions. The three words that I want to talk about are the words perfect, work, and wisdom. First of all, let's talk about this word perfect. Your translation probably has the word perfect in there somewhere. This is an important word in the Bible, and it's one that I talk about a lot, so many of you have heard me talk about this before. This is the Greek word teleos. Something is teleos when it has arrived at its intended goal. An acorn is not teleos. The oak tree is teleos. The acorn has this potential to turn into an oak tree, but it hasn't arrived there yet. When it becomes the oak tree, now it is perfect. Now it has matured. Now it has become what it was intended to be. In fact, the New American Standard often translates this word mature, although it doesn't in this context. It's important, I think, to understand this because we tend to think of the word perfect to mean without flaw in any way. So if I were to describe myself as perfect, you would all laugh. I guess it's because I didn't describe myself as perfect that you didn't laugh. The fact is that if any of us were to make that claim, what we would think we were saying is, you could examine any aspect of my life you wanted and you would find no flaw in it anywhere. Well, that's not really what this word is getting at least most of the time. Teleos has to do with whether something has arrived at its intended goal. So the acorn is meant to grow into the oak tree. Now, the oak tree may not be perfect in comparison with all the other trees. I mean, this oak tree can have a gash in its bark over here, or this one has a broken limb over here or something, but that's not the issue. The oak tree is perfect in the sense that it has grown up into that which it was intended to be. It is now the oak tree. So that's why oftentimes this word maturity is the way that the New American Standard ends up translating this. In fact, sometimes it's literally talking about the difference between the child and the adult. the mature one, the one who has grown up to become what a human being is supposed to be. So I would argue that in James, we're going to see this concept, and the issue that we're talking about here is this idea of maturity, having become that what you are supposed to be. And in particular, we're talking about the maturing of our faith. James is not saying that the result of perseverance is that we become without moral flaw in any way, but what he is saying is that we mature, that our faith becomes what it is supposed to be. And that's what I'm going to argue throughout the book. Now, his first use of this word is he says that perseverance has a perfect work. And that's another word that we need to talk about. Work or works is a very important and a very challenging concept in James. If you're anything like me, you probably somewhere along the line ran into some of James' statements about works, like we're justified by works and not by faith alone. And if you're anything like me, you were probably very troubled by that statement, trying to figure out what in the world does he mean by a thing like that, especially since it seems to contradict what Paul says about the very same thing. And, you know, I like Paul's version. If I had to choose between them, I mean, to talk about being forgiven and accepted by God in spite of my works, in spite of what I do, that's the message I need to hear. And to have someone come along and somehow tie my justification to what I do is a pretty scary thing to say. So this is a challenging concept because Paul and James seem to be thinking about works in two different ways. I think his use of the word here, you may not see it in your translation, but literally what we have here is that perseverance is to have a perfect work. That's what he says. And I think this is related to his use of the word work throughout the letter. The problem is that we, as Protestants especially, tend to have kind of a technical definition that we give to the idea of works. We think of phrases like, we are not saved by works of the law, or we are not saved by our own righteous works, or something like that. The basic idea of the word, though, is one that we don't want to be afraid of. The basic idea is talking about what I do. A work is an action. It's just a way of talking about what it is that I actually do when I do things. James' primary concern is that my actions be in keeping with what I say I believe. There is, on the one hand, what I say I'm about, and then on the other hand, there is what I do. That is the issue that James is going to be concerned with throughout the letter. And I would argue this is a very different issue than what Paul is getting at when he talks about works. And in fact, the whole concept of works in Paul's thinking and in James' thinking is quite different. They're thinking about two different things. Paul asks, for example, in order to be saved, must my works, my actions, be in keeping with the Jewish law? And his answer is no. Paul also asks another question, I would argue. In order to be saved, must my works, my actions, be without sin? And again, I would say his answer is no, and it's one of the most fundamentally important answers that he gives, that my acceptance before God is on the basis of the work of Christ on the cross. It is not on the basis of my worthiness. So, I am not saved by religious works, nor am I saved by meritorious works, works that show how worthy I am to be saved. That's what Paul's talking about when he's talking about works. James, I think, is asking a very different question. In order to be saved, must my works, my actions, demonstrate the reality of my faith? And his answer to that question, I would argue, is yes. But I would also argue that that's a very different question than the question that Paul is asking. For James, faith starts as an inner reality in the heart. The testing of my faith that he's talking about, however, brings that inner reality out where it can be seen in my actions. The question is ultimately, am I acting in such a way that you can see that I actually do, in fact, believe the gospel? The question is not, am I acting in such a way to show that I am a morally perfect person who deserves to be saved? The answer is no, I am not acting in that way. But the question is, am I acting in such a way that my claim to be a believer is credible and testified to by the reality of my life? The great example of this for James we will see in chapter 2. God tested Abraham by asking him to sacrifice Isaac. And James will argue, Abraham had works. That is, he responded by obeying God and going to offer up Isaac. James says of this, you see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. Now we're going to talk about that when we get to that passage. But I just point out here the connection again between the idea of works and perfection or maturing. James sees faith as something that starts out as an inner, implicit thing and then is perfected, is matured through actually acting on that faith. Faith starts out as a real but immature part of our lives. Under trial, it is forced out into the open, and in the process, it matures. That's what I would argue that James is talking about here. Okay, there's a third word that I want to talk about then, and then we'll try to put the whole thing together. That word is wisdom. There is a very popular way of taking this verse. This verse says, if anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. In fact, I'm trying to decide whether I have ever heard anyone teach this passage to say what I think James is actually saying, and I'm not sure that I can recall anyone doing it. But it is very common to hear people take this verse as basically saying, this is how you find God's will for your life. I need wisdom. I'm trying to decide, should I take that job or that job? You know, I take that job and it means I have to move to Pittsburgh. I take this job and it means I stay here. But that job, you know, it has more money and more opportunity, and I'm not sure what I should do. God knows which one is going to work out best for me, so I'll ask him, and he will give me wisdom on this subject, and then I'll know what I ought to do. That's a very common way of taking this, that this is a promise that God will tell me what I ought to do. If I believe him, if I really believe that he will, God will tell me what I ought to do and what will work out best in any situation if I really believe that he will. This is, I have to, maybe I'm just reading the wrong stuff, but this is what I've seen over and over again. Well, I would argue that that's not what James is getting at. That's very far from James' intention. He has something very different in mind, something much more in keeping with the strong current of the biblical message. And I have three reasons for thinking that he means something different, and let me talk to you about those three reasons. First of all, I would point to the context of the whole letter. James is writing to churches where many people say they are Christians, but they live as if they believed something else. Some of them would like to be teachers and leaders, we will find, but in fact they are fools who have no true wisdom at all and really shouldn't be up front leading people. Let me, for example, quote something from chapter 3. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his works in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So, we can see certainly in that context, wisdom is not, gee, I don't know whether I should take the job in Pittsburgh or not. Wisdom is having a godly perspective and understanding about life, seeing life around you the way God sees it, such that that becomes reflected in the way you live and conduct yourself. And I would argue that that's the issue throughout the whole book. So to lack wisdom in the context of James is not to be unsure whether I should take that job or that job, or whether I should marry that person or something like that. To lack wisdom is to be a fool. It is a serious issue to lack wisdom in the book of James. If I lack wisdom, I am immature and foolish. I lack perspective. I do not understand life the way God does. So that's my first reason for saying that I think that it is that sort of thing that he has in mind when he talks about us, that if we lack wisdom, we should ask God. Reason number two. In the context, in the immediate context, he says, perseverance is to have a perfect work, that you may be perfect and sound, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom. Notice his argument. He's saying, perseverance in faith is meant to bring us to maturity, to perfect our faith, to make it so that we are lacking in nothing that we ought to have. But if you lack wisdom, he says. Wisdom is clearly at least part of, and I would say essentially, the content of what it is we're supposed to gain through persevering in faith. By persevering in faith, we will be matured. We will lack nothing. But what if you do lack, he says, and the thing that you lack, he says, is wisdom? What if, in fact, we have not matured? We look at our lives and our faith is not mature. It is lacking, and we are lacking in wisdom. In other words, what if we have been convicted by the message of the letter of James to recognize that we are fools, that we have lived our lives in a way that is foolish and not in keeping with the gospel that we say we believe? That's the question that James is addressing. So, perseverance is meant to lead to maturity so that we lack nothing that we should have in our faith. But what if we do lack? What if we are missing wisdom? I would say then that the connection here shows that in James' mind, this wisdom is another way of talking about this maturing, this perfecting process that the testing of our faith brings about. That wisdom and maturity are really two ways of talking about the same thing. And the issue that he's raising is, I'm saying that what ought to happen is that persevering in the midst of the trials of your faith should lead to maturity. But what if it doesn't? What if you are still lacking? You are still unwise and foolish? What should you do? Which brings me to my third reason for arguing this. James says that if we lack wisdom, we should ask God, who gives to all generously and without reproach. And my question is, why is it that James says that God will not reproach us? He will not get on our case. He will not condemn us and say, no, no, you're messed up. If the issue is I'm trying to decide whether I should take the job in Pittsburgh or not, what would God have to reproach me for? I'm not omniscient. I don't know the future. I don't know how things are going to turn out. That's why I'm asking God in that case, right? God, tell me which one in your knowledge of everything is going to work out the best for me. That's what I really want to know. Well, what is there to reproach me for in that? How could I know the answer to that question? But if we're talking about lacking wisdom in the sense that James uses it elsewhere in the letter, that is, I do not have a godly, wise perspective on life, then that really is something that I could be reproached for. That God could look at me and say, you're coming to, a fool like you is coming to me looking for wisdom. But what James is saying is, God is generous, and he gives without reproach. I can go to him in all of my shame for being a fool, And yet I can expect him to be generous and to not rebuke me, but to rather receive me and raise me up. So when you put all of those things together, the context, how James is talking about wisdom in the rest of the letter, the fact that here wisdom seems to be that thing that we shouldn't be lacking if the process of persevering in faith has done its work, the same thing as maturity, and the fact that he says that God will not reproach us for lacking it, I think all of that suggests that we're not talking about just finding God's will for my life. We're talking about that fundamental question. Do I have a wise perspective on life or not? Do I understand what life is about and what I ought to be pursuing and what is valuable? Or am I pursuing foolish things that in the end are going to get me nowhere? That's the issue, I think. So, our three words here come down to this. Perfect, that's talking about maturity and completeness in our life of faith. Work is talking about an active result in my life. And wisdom is talking about a godly perspective on what is true and important in life. That being the case, then, let me give you another broad paraphrase of what I think James is saying in verses 4 and 5. Now, this process of persevering in faith under trial is meant to have a maturing result in your life as a believer, so that you might be mature and whole in your faith, lacking in nothing that a mature believer should have. But what should you do if you realize that this is not true of you? What should you do if you realize that you do lack wisdom and maturity in your life? You should ask God. He is generous and will not hold your foolishness against you. He can and will bring you to wisdom and maturity. That's what I think James is saying. Okay, now I have three questions that I want to ask and answer that I hope will help bring out a little bit what I think James is saying here. First of all, why is he saying all this? What does this have to do with his overall purpose in this letter? Why is he saying what perseverance is supposed to produce? What is he telling us, or more particularly, what is he telling his readers here, the churches that he's writing to, that they need to hear? As I have been saying, James is deeply concerned about the sorry state of the churches to which he is writing. They have been going through great hardships, but the response of many has been bad. He sees selfishness, jealousy, greed, ambition, even murder among them. We're going to see as we go through the letter the specifics of the kinds of issues that he addresses as he talks to them. He starts out by encouraging them to rejoice when their faith is tested by trials, because this leads to the opportunity to persevere in their faith. Perseverance in faith is a valuable and good thing. But now I think he wants to clarify. The kind of perseverance he is talking about is that which actually has a result in our lives. It matures and completes our faith. To the foolish, ambitious, selfish, greedy, murderous people that he's writing to, who might say, oh yeah, well, we persevered. I mean, look, we still go to church, don't we? We still hang out with the Christians, don't we? I still call myself a Christian. I think what James is trying to get across to them is that the sort of perseverance he's talking about is the real deal, the kind that has really, in the midst of some struggle of life, looked at some truth of the gospel about God's merciful character or about my own sinfulness or something like that, and has confronted it and recognized, yes, this is true, and I need to act on this thing. True perseverance means confronting the implications of the gospel in real life and deciding, yes, that's true. That is what I want my life to be about. It is the result of that process that matures our faith. So, as we're going to see, the tone of the book of James, the letter that James writes, is actually quite negative. He uses some very strong language to these churches, like you adulteresses, and that sort of thing, because what he sees is this problem where you have a group of people who are supposedly gathered around the message of the gospel, and yet the way they are conducting their lives looks as if they don't understand or believe that gospel at all. So what he's warning them here is that the perseverance he's talking about is the sort of thing that actually has an impact in your life. And then he wants to give a quick word of comfort. And if, in fact, when you hear me saying that, you recognize that this is not true of you, what should you do? Should you despair? No, the thing to do is to turn to God. He is the one who can bring you wisdom. Okay, so this is really his opening salvo in a very strong word of both exhortation and encouragement in this letter. The exhortation being, there are serious issues involved here, and many of you don't seem to be paying attention. And yet the encouragement being that there is always forgiveness and restoration with God, if you're interested. And the real question of the letter is, are you interested? Okay, my second question is this. How does this process work? James says that perseverance in the process of having our faith tested, persevering in my faith under trial, leads to a maturity and wisdom. How is that the case? What is it that he's talking about? What should I expect to see? Well, it's hard to say just from the verses that we've looked at, because he hasn't said at this point. He doesn't explain why such a thing would be true. I think some of the aspects of his thinking will become clearer as we go through the letter. I think the rest of the Bible makes it even clearer what sort of thing that he has in mind. And I think reflection on the experience of Christians also can help us see how such a thing might be. We're going to be talking about this a lot as we go through the letter. Let me just give you a quick sort of picture of how I see it, and then this will be emerging more as we go along. I want to start with an analogy. I made up a story. It's not a very good story, but it's a story. It'll serve its purpose. It starts out as a very good story. You have a very good job that pays you very well. See, this is a good story. It starts with, okay, however, one of your coworkers tells you that your boss is doing some terrible, illegal, and immoral things. You listen to what your coworker says, and you become convinced that it is true. The evidence is overwhelming, and you agree. You're right. The boss is doing great evil, and by doing your job, you are aiding and abetting him. So you have come to believe that that's the case. For a while, however, you don't really want to think about it. The problem is, this is a good job and you don't want to lose it. And yet, at the same time, you believe the story that your coworker has told you, that there's some terrible stuff going on here. And you're kind of in this place where you would sort of like to keep doing your job and believe this at the same time. And somehow, it'll all work out. Now, one day, the magnitude of what the boss is doing has become so clear that your friend and coworker stands up at a staff meeting and confronts the boss over what he's doing. This creates a great tension, an atmosphere of great division in because there are a lot of people who have good jobs and whose careers and livelihood are dependent on this boss. But this coworker stands up courageously and he says, okay, this is the deal. This is what's going on. In response, the boss looks at everyone else in the meeting and basically is asking, so who's with me and who's against me? You are either for me or against me. Who else believes what this guy is saying? Now, there you are. Up to this point, you have in fact believed what it is that the coworker is saying, but now you are put in a spot where you're going to have to decide, what am I going to do about it? What am I going to actually do about this belief that I have about what's going on? And so you raise a very shaky hand and say, I think he's right. What is the result in your life, besides the fact that you get fired, of course? I mean, you know you get fired. That's part of the story. But first of all, your action is a reflection of the reality of the belief that you had. You really did believe that what this guy was saying was true and that it was important. You understood that that was the case. Up till that point, your beliefs were real, but they were sort of invisible. You looked like everyone else in the office, and you were sort of hoping that you weren't going to have to do anything about it. This is one of the themes that James talks about. This is the idea of the proving of our faith, that trials are that opportunity where we actually demonstrate that we really do believe what it is we say we believe. But now we're talking about a second result from our being under trial, and that is this maturity and wisdom. Think about your story here. Up until that point, you were trying to live in two incompatible worlds. You believed that the boss was bad, but you were also trying to live as if somehow that were not true. And if you were to look at the way you conducted yourself as an employee and the decisions you made, there would be a certain incongruence to it all. You couldn't actually conduct yourself in a way that ultimately made sense because you were trying to live in two different worlds at the same time. But now, having had to act on your beliefs, you have had to face into it. Yes, I really do believe that this is true, and I recognize that it has implications, that things are different than the way I wanted them to be or thought that they were. I've come to see that the situation is different. You took the plunge. You realized that if your beliefs about the boss were true, you had to do something about it. And now if you think about the next job you get, you're going to be a different sort of employee in that situation. You have come to recognize that I have to hold loosely to this. There are things more important than keeping my job. And that the way you conduct yourself from then on is going to be different because you have come to that place where you are willing to see that what you believe has an impact on life, and you're going to live with and embrace the implications of that. You know, it's kind of like, you know, there's tons of movies that where this sort of thing happens, where some character for a while seems caught on whether he's going to admit and acknowledge that certain things are true or not, and only ultimately to show that he has come around by some action that he does. You know, end of Star Wars, Han Solo's got all the loot and he's taken off, you know, and he says, you know, I've got to take care of myself. And then in the end he comes through and shows that he's, you know, he really understands what's important after all. So what happens in the second movie? They've got him a general or something in the army. Why is that? Because he has demonstrated through his actions that his perspective on things has taken deep enough hold that his judgment is trustworthy, that he knows which side he ought to be on and what he ought to do. Well, I think that's the kind of thing that we're talking about here. Through the process of our faith being tested and having to decide that the gospel itself is true and what we're about, that we gain in perspective. Now we have been tested and we have come through to the point where we have put our weight on this. We're saying, yeah, we think that this is strong enough to hold us up. And that brings perspective and wisdom to the way we look at life. The gospel has a whole set of corollary ideas that come with it that we have to embrace. That God exists, that God is good, that God is merciful, that I am evil and guilty, that I need God's mercy, that Christ's death on the cross is my salvation and God's provision for my guilt. That the coming kingdom of God is more valuable than anything this world can offer me, that I really need the salvation that he's offering, and that there's nothing more valuable in the world. All of those things are related to this gospel message that we embrace. And in our lives, God takes us through circumstances where we have to confront those issues. Not all of them at once sometimes, maybe just one or in this situation, maybe another one in another situation. Maybe I have always been a sort of proud, self-righteous person, and the circumstances of my life have brought me to the place where I have to act in such a way that I admit that I am in the wrong, that I am a sinner, and that I am guilty. Maybe I have always loved money, and I have been brought to the place where I have to decide whether I care more about money or the promises of God. Maybe I've always really cared deeply what people thought about me, and I've had to act in such a way that being faithful to God is going to cost me the goodwill of people that I want to think highly of me. I'm going to have to decide, am I going to follow God, or am I going to care more about what people think about me? Maybe God has withheld from me something I really want, and I have to decide whether I really believe in God's goodness. There are many different flavors of all of this. These trials are usually difficult and often messy, and by that I mean that in the midst of those trials we often do not shine as we're trying to sort it all out. But in the end, we ultimately come to realize what is important to us, and we emerge with some maturity and wisdom. Okay. My third question then is, what does this result look like? What does it mean to have Christian wisdom and maturity? And again, we will see that better as we go through the letter, as we see some specific examples that he's going to talk about. But let me just say this now. First of all, what it is not, I always want to emphasize this because it's important that we do not get the wrong perspective on this stuff. First of all, wisdom does not mean that we are without sin. In fact, I would argue that part of wisdom is being able to see one's own sin clearly for what it is. You know, this is something I've said, and the older I get, nothing in my experience has falsified it. I've been saying it for 15, 20 years, and 15 and 20 years has only more deeply convinced me that it's true. That part of the human, the experience of a Christian, living the Christian life, often is not the sense that I am getting better and better, but the sense that I am getting worse and worse. What I mean by that is not that now I'm gleefully running off and doing awful things. I don't mean that. But it is the more I come to understand what the character of God is all about, what Jesus was like as a person, what I am being called to, the more I recognize how far I fall short of that. The more I experience myself in many different scenarios, the more I come to recognize how deep a problem I'm wrestling with. There's a reason why Jesus described the scenario of having a log in your own eye and worrying about the splinter that it's in somebody else's eye. I think that's because my personal experience with myself ought to be enough to show me how big the problem is that I have. So, wisdom does not mean that now I am a morally perfect person. I still have the same struggle with myself that I have always had, I would argue, and that the Bible teaches that. But my perspective on things is changing. And that does have a difference on the way I act. It's also the case that wisdom does not mean that we do not suffer in hard times. That's another intolerable burden that we put on each other, that somehow you show your maturity of faith by having hard and difficult things come at you and you can brush them off without a sweat. Ah, doesn't bother me. Death, no big deal. Loss, suffering, hey, you know, rolls right off my back. That's not the case. It didn't roll off Jesus' back. He suffered in many ways, and he wasn't embarrassed to suffer. But wisdom does mean that there is something more than suffering, that ultimately we can find a place to stand in the midst of our suffering. Wisdom does mean, I think, that because we are growing to see the strength of sin in our own lives, we are learning to be compassionate toward the failings of others. Because we are growing to see how wonderful God's promises are, we are learning to hold more loosely to the things of this world. Because we are growing in our understanding of God's trustworthiness, we are learning to be hopeful in the midst of a despairing world, and many other things that we could talk about. It is not a lack of sin, but it is not nothing either. It is a growth, a wisdom, a maturity, a perspective on life that gives me a place to stand and from which to live in a way that makes sense with the way things are. These are some of the qualities of the wise. Okay, so there's a number of things that I could say about all of this. Let me just say two to conclude with. First of all, it seems very apparent to me that a key part of God's agenda for our lives is that we might grow up in faith, gaining wisdom and maturity. I think it's basically, in a way, it's at least part of the reason why when we become believers, God just doesn't snatch us up to heaven and say, okay, you're saved, next. I mean, why do we go through all of this stuff? What is the value in hanging around and wrestling with all of this stuff? And it is a real wrestling match at times. Well, it is that process of growing from folly to wisdom, that there is something very valuable about coming to see what life is all about in the midst of a world that is not seeing what life is all about. That's a very important part of what God is doing, of God's agenda, I think, and James is making that clear. And I like to know what God's agenda is, as far as I'm concerned. And I think James is telling us, you want to know what his agenda is? This is a very important part of it, is coming to see who you are before God and what's really valuable in the midst of a world where it's very hard to see those things. And then the second thing I'd like to say is, I don't know about you guys, it is very personally important to me to understand what God has and has not promised to do, if you know what I mean. I mean, I feel like I have suffered in my life from a whole series of teachings from a variety of people, from a variety of perspectives, where they have said, if you do this, then God has promised that he will respond with this. And, I mean, you name it. There's any number of things that you can find out there that people have promised. Certainly, there are strong voices in the Christian media who would say things like, God has promised to make me rich, God has promised to make me healthy, and so on, and that somehow, if I am not finding myself rich and healthy, it's due to a lack of faith on my part. Well, that's a terrible thing to teach, I think, and I'm putting people in a situation where they're going to be approaching God expecting that that's what he has promised, and then be terribly disappointed when they find out that that's not necessarily what he does. That's why it's important to me to recognize what James is saying here. James is not saying, as much as I might like this to be the case, he is not saying God promises that if you want to know the future, if you want to know what you ought to do so that things will work out best for you, ask him, believing, and he will tell you, and you'll always find the most profitable thing to do if you ask him. What he is promising, though, is not to answer my prayer for wealth or not to answer my prayer for infallible guidance, but to answer my prayer for wisdom. That just as it is God's agenda that I would mature in my faith, thus, it is also true that I can with confidence call out to God, asking him to bring some wisdom and maturity into my life, because that's what he wants, and he is willing and able to do it. I am a weak and foolish person, but that does not change God's ability to make me wise or his willingness to do so. He knows my weakness, but he is generous and willing to lift me up from my foolishness. So what I see of importance in what James is saying, and I'm sure there are many other things, but what strikes me this morning anyway, is that I seek God's agenda for my life, to bring wisdom into my life, and that in fact, as I come to see the need for it in my life, I can with confidence call out to Him, and He will in fact answer that prayer. Okay, well, I actually left time for questions, which is, I'm not very good at, I know. But here's your shot.
Congratulations, Ron.
Thanks. Don't get used to it.
I'm just trying to think of how to summarize it. What I'm hearing you say is, I think there's so much within us and so much within our culture, Christian culture in particular, that's wanting to tell us what the agenda, we want to know the agenda. I want to know what I'm supposed to do a year from now, 5 years from now. I want to know, And I'm hearing you say the agenda is not about what, it's about how. It's about how we go about making decisions, how we go about, whether it's through wisdom or through doubt. That's what's important. That it's really, God doesn't really care what we do. It's how we go about doing it that's more important.
Yeah, my minor claim is that this passage is focused on the second rather than the first. But yeah, I will go with you as far as to say that I think those who have tried to paint from other passages as well, the idea that somehow our what we're looking for from God is somehow this roadmap for what exactly I ought to do so that I can maximize the benefit and that kind of stuff. I'm very much sympathetic with the argument of a book that was written, 20 years ago, by Gary Friesen about finding the will of God, where he basically argued, I think very much in keeping with the kind of thing we're seeing here, that the issue is not having God whisper in my ear some particular thing I'm supposed to do, but developing wisdom, gaining the perspective so that I can look at my life and see this would be a wise course, this would not. And if there is no, maybe there is no difference in that way, then do what seems best.
But you hear so much out there about trying to determine the will of God, but it comes out sounding more like spin the bottle or like some Ouija board thing, as opposed to just the will of God is to get up in the morning and love your wife and seek humility and
right.
What happens or what comes your way is really
right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So I would like to argue that this passage is reinforcing that idea. This is what James is saying. God is using the hard things in our life to bring about that we would gain perspective on what is important and that kind of thing. And yes, I agree that ultimately that's all the Bible is concerned with. We won't ever find it saying, here's the way that you can get God to tell you which of these choices is the one that's going to pay off for you the best or something like that.
Thanks, Ron, for the message. That was very good. I was thinking along with you and recalling some of the classes I've taken on James, and in particular in light of Greek class and what J.B. Taves has written about. And, of course, I'm going back to when the Earth's crust was cooling back in 1975. But at any rate, one of the questions that arose in my mind while you were speaking, which I believe can be a great addition, is a simple question like, what is the work that God has His hand of blessing upon? What is that work? And in my opinion, the apostles weren't stupid. They knew they could die any time. And so how much bypassing the question of how long do we have to live as evidence of even the fact that babies can die, tsunamis hit, all of the tragedy, and life is short, on and on, through war and what have you. What can we do now? And what is that blessing? Well, Abel didn't have very long to live because his brother murdered him, but the thing that he did do that reflected that which showed that he had faith was that he brought a blood sacrifice, which was significant of the fact that the Messiah was coming. And all of these things in the Old Testament, all the works that I see, are in preservation of the seed of Abraham. All of these things that float right around the gospel. And so the work that I believe God has his hand of blessing upon is all that goes into each and every one of us coming to different situations in our lives where we're able to be outgoing and proclaim the gospel to others. Otherwise, just works in and of themselves becomes nothing more than what any other religious group does. For example, when a church runs out of things to talk about Jesus, then they've run out of things to say. And they become like any other group. It doesn't matter what group they are, the form doesn't mean anything. And it's meaningless to even come to a church that does not proclaim the gospel of the fact that Christ alone is righteous. So this is the great work today that I believe God has his hand of blessing upon, because he's given us only one specific thing, and that's the Great Commission. And that's to be outgoing, and that is gathering around words. The only perfect work and the only perfect words, I believe, are the words of Christ and the good news that he alone is the only person that God accepts. And it's faith that the Spirit gives us in that is what causes us to have wisdom as a result of reasoning upon those presuppositions.
Yeah, I like what you're saying, George, about the work. It's not some particular work, good work, that in and of itself that it's about, but it is what we're about that leads to doing those things. Are we committed to the gospel and thus our lives reflecting that or not? That's good.
Okay, I appreciated your analogy, or someone's, that typically finding the will of God is kind of similar to using a Ouija board, sometimes it seems like, or how it's presented it should be. I kind of have two questions related to that. Is there any New Testament precedent for actually seeking a specific will of God in any specific matter?
Did you said you had two questions? Well, should I answer that one and then you go do the second one? Or?
Maybe. The second one, though, is Old Testament is very full of it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm wondering is, what is the difference between our relationship to God in that it may have changed from one to the other? That if I agree with you that this seems to be more about a worldview, so why has that changed?
Yeah. Well, here's how I look at that stuff. God is not an abstract principle. God is the creator of the universe. He is a person that I am interacting with. And he has interacted with us as a part of his creation in a variety of ways. So when you have God setting up a religious system where he puts a symbol of his presence in the midst of Israel, and he has, you know, he himself is saying, Moses is going to come into the tent and I'm going to talk to him and then he's going to come out and tell you what it is that I said. Clearly God has reached out on a number of occasions to communicate to people specifically what it is he's thinking. And that's in fact why we have the Bible, because we have all these people with whom God has communicated in such a way that they can tell us what he's thinking. So in a way it didn't change. I mean, Paul encountering Jesus on the Damascus Road and saying he was taken up into the third heaven and that Jesus revealed to him what the things of the gospel and all of that, that's not all that different than Moses going in and talking to God in the temple, or, you know, a prophet having a vision, that sort of thing. So God is always prepared to step out and communicate to us in specific ways. But we also see at the same time that there's a precedent for God not doing that. Like, you know, there Israel, the prophets at various times talking about, you know, it's been a long time and there's been no word from the Lord, you know, or that period of time after the time of the prophets and before Jesus came, it being hundreds of years long and nobody's, God's not saying anything. So the question is not, in my mind, is not, does God sometimes communicate in that way, but rather, how can I best understand how God wants to interact with me? And right now, the way I would put it together is, what I see in the New Testament is a focus on the idea that, yes, there are gifts of the Spirit, there are apostles, there are prophets who, through the work of the Spirit, have been given access to some information from God. You know, Agabus comes to Paul and says, you know, I've had this revelation, you're going to be carried off to Rome and that kind of stuff. So those kind of things are gifts that God gives to some people at some time for his own purpose so that he might communicate, and in particular in those times when the scriptures are being formed and we're getting direct messages from God explaining to us what the whole thing is about. But when I see the apostles like Paul and all of them writing to the churches, what they're concerned with is not that everyone ought to have the gift of being a prophet and hearing from God, but rather that everyone would understand the gospel such that they would have wisdom and maturity as they're living their lives. So I'm not prepared to rule out. I'm still open to the possibility that somebody could come along and say, I think God has told me something. I'm not saying it can't happen, but what I am saying is that those passages that people tend to take and say, see, this is a promise that God's going to do that, I'd say, no, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about something more like what James is getting at here. And I do admit that I'm a little bit on the skeptical side with the I got a message from God stuff, especially when it's people whose theology is so bad that if you were to believe it, it would cast you straight into hell. I was thinking, you know, why, while God was giving you this message about, you know, how you can make more money, why didn't he bother to straighten you out on, you know, your soul and where you're going to spend eternity? So, I mean, I know that sounds like a very harsh thing to say, but, I mean, the fact is, that's, I mean, I have to find myself wondering, I don't recognize the God that you tell me is giving you messages. So sometimes there's that as well. But it's not like God has somehow ceased to be a person who can communicate. I mean, he can do whatever he wants and will. It's just when I look at the admonitions in the Bible, the admonitions are not go out there and listen to that little voice to figure out what you're supposed to do. The admonitions are come to understand the truth so that you're not a fool when you're looking at life. Okay, maybe we could stop there then. We've got actually on time. This is amazing. There must be... this is evidence that what I've said is an anointed message this morning because we actually ended on time.